Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, July 2nd, 2018. South Sudanese living in Australia say reconciliation is key to a peace deal.
You can't just brush aside trauma. And now the trauma has multiplied. And Rick Machar has been part of it.
And one South Sudanese priest in the diaspora answers the question, can real peace in South Sudan ever be achieved?
We are not aiming to really achieve a total peace or unity, but we are aiming to achieve at least something.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. An Australian civil society group is working with South Sudanese community leaders in Melbourne to encourage reconciliation among the different ethnic groups polarized by the conflict in South Sudan. Mike Brown is with Initiatives of Change Australia. That's a worldwide movement of people committed to the transformation of society through changes in human behavior. And he says there will be no peace in South Sudan until President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar apologize to the South Sudanese people.
I think reconciliation doesn't work, and there was a whole movement for reconciliation here. I was part of it. I was on the State Committee for Reconciliation. I believed in it. But the Aboriginal pastor who said to me there can be no national reconciliation without national repentance, saying sorry, recognizing the injustices, I think that deeper exploration is needed. So probably it is so in South Sudan too. When I first went to South Sudan, on the second day I was there in 2011, we were invited to the vice president's residence by his wife, Angelina Teng. And Rick Machar, I met him for the first time. He said, what do you do in Australia? So I said, about reconciliation. And he said, well, that's what we need here. We're a traumatized nation. We've had 50 years of war. His wife turned to him and said, yes, and you're traumatized and you don't even realize it. And it was out of that conversation we realized you can't just brush aside trauma. And now the trauma has multiplied. And Rick Machar has been part of it. So if peace is to come, we have to go deep enough and to see ways to recognize the history which still wounds, the people who've died, the stories that have been told which perpetuate the bitterness. And that's true in Australia as it is true in South Sudan.
And initiatives of change. What is it doing here in Australia?
Well, just to explain, the premise of initiatives of change is that if we want to change the world, we have to start with ourselves. We have to start with the individual. And that as we listen to the inner voice, the Spirit of God, the truth, we can find ways to make that practical. 10 years ago, really, some young South Sudanese, lost boys, David Vincent, Nyok Gor, and many others with them, began to explore their own need of healing. And out of that grew their wish to bring the South Sudanese community together. So initiatives of change didn't design it this way. We simply wanted to support them, and that is still the same today. They have started what they call the South Sudan Australia Peace Initiative. And Initiatives of Change supports that. We also raised quite a bit of money to send, I think it was about 15 Australians to South Sudan in 2013 to help with the training of the peace mobilizers and the peace initiative that we tried to undertake then in that little window of peace before the fighting started.
The situation in South Sudan has multiple effects on South Sudanese outside the country. We've had instances of friends not seeing each other eye to eye after the 2013 violence in Juba. The question of reconciliation has been what everybody was speaking about this morning here. Is reconciliation possible among South Sudanese?
I don't want to be arrogant to say that it is just possible. I believe it is possible through deep honesty and forgiveness and living into each other's pains. I gave the demonstration, the example of Nyok, a Dinka Boer, who built a relationship with Peter Kaka, a Murley man, when both of them had lost relatives in the last months. It was when they were still grieving. And they came together in their grief, and they became a symbol of unity. And that's right at the heart of this initiative here. So that's just one example. I think it's those courageous reaching across the divides that can actually bring the peace.
The last question here, if you have an opportunity to speak directly to President Kiir and Dr. Riek Machar, what would you tell them at this time?
I don't know what I can say as an outsider. I grieve for every life lost. And I think I would say what I said to Riek Machar in 2014 in Addis, when I met him in his hotel, that there can be no peace until you and Salva Kiir can stand in front of the John Garang Mausoleum and apologize to your country.
That is Mike Brown of the group Initiatives of Change Australia. He was speaking with my colleague John Tanza in Melbourne over the weekend. As momentum picks up in the Sudanese capital Khartoum for a final peace deal in South Sudan, a South Sudanese Anglican priest in Australia says the diaspora should take the lead in healing the wounds created by the conflict. Reverend Chaplain Soma says if South Sudanese in the diaspora from different ethnic backgrounds can sit down and break bread together, there is hope that those divided by 5 years of fighting can reconcile and forgive one another.
It's one way of We're trying to work together as clergy in the Church of God, and then also to bring our main South Sudanese tribal groups together, because we have been working, but again, not working together as what we think could be. And our main reason is to be able to would be united, and there we continue on to our National Day of Prayer, which will be on the 14th of July in St. Paul's Cathedral.
What is the end game here, Reverend? What is the end game?
The end game is to have unity and peace among ourselves. And this peace will reflect or will show our fellow South Sudanese back home that we are united and we are working together.
I hate to be sarcastic here. Mm. Is it possible to achieve that unity and peace, given the polarization and the ethnic hatred that has been there from 2013?
We are not aiming to really achieve a total peace or unity, but we are aiming to achieve at least something, at least a very small amount of peace within few people that might in future be able to be extended to the others.
And what is your takeaway from the testimonies that you've been hearing from people this morning here?
I take away the fact of how open people are in an environment such as this. For example, the Nuer and the Dinkas have not been given a chance like this, where they could speak openly to each other and share together, even sharing food together, and sharing so many things in common together. And that's the takeaway of me and many others that would be going out and with the understanding that we seem to be coming closer to each other. And the idea of socialization during lunch as well is another part of bringing people together.
Your prophetic role is to speak on behalf of the people, the oppressed, if you like. That's the prophetic role of the church. There are other people who have been pointing fingers at the clergy that you use the pulpit sometimes to politicize the issues in South Sudan. Is that the case in Melbourne?
I do think to some extent maybe, but of course where I operate, we try very hard to minimize that or try not to to use the pulpit for the situation in South Sudan.
Given this conference is just one event, one day, is there some other individual one-to-one outreach that the church is planning to do as a follow-up? Because you said you were impressed to see that people who never, sat together, ate together, today did that. Are you going to follow up on that momentum?
We are going to follow up. And after this, and after the other main event on the 14th of July, we would probably form something that is similar to the Australian Council of Churches here, which would be a body that represents the South Sudanese in Victoria, which could also be extended to the other states in Australia.
That is Chaplain Soma, a South Sudanese Anglican priest, speaking with John Tanza this past weekend in the Kooyong suburb of Melbourne, Australia. The special representative of the United Nations Secretary General in South Sudan welcomes the Khartoum Declaration of Agreement signed by President Kiir and Riek Machar and other opposition leaders last week. But David Shearer is urging the leaders to implement that ceasefire effectively. There were reports of attacks between government and opposition forces over the weekend. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
The ceasefire went into effect on Saturday but was reportedly violated within hours. Government and opposition forces reportedly clashed in Wau on Saturday. SPLAIO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampaul Gabriel says government forces attacked their positions on Saturday morning, an allegation SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lulurwai Kwang denies. Kwang claims rebels attacked their positions in Sokare, Kajukeji County of Yei River State on Saturday. Gabriel says government forces attacked their position in that area. UNMISS Chief David Sierra says if the warring parties adhere to the deal, it will enable aid agencies to deliver aid to thousands of vulnerable civilians across the country who are cut off by the conflict.
A permanent ceasefire, importantly, will enable the United Nations and the humanitarian organisations to reach, and safely reach, families and communities with humanitarian assistance, and more importantly, for people themselves to move forward with their own lives, and particularly to cultivate and to continue to live in peace and rebuild their lives.
Despite the reports of some fighting around the time the ceasefire went into effect, Sierra says the Khartoum Agreement has injected new momentum into the peace process. Sierra says recent fighting, especially clashes in the northern part of the country, has made thousands of people more vulnerable. Sierra, who visited Ganiel and Lier in former Unity State 2 weeks ago, says both government and rebel forces recently committed human rights abuses in those areas, including killings. Information Minister Michael Makwe recently said President Kiir was not willing to work with Machar again. But Sierra sees the ceasefire deal as a positive starting point for a more comprehensive peace agreement. Machar plays an active role in the process.
It's important that all parties, including Riek Machar's, are part of the process so it is genuinely inclusive and can ultimately be successful. The agreement in Khartoum has injected new momentum into the peace process, and we are very encouraged by this development.
Delegates representing the various warring parties in Khartoum continue to negotiate on contentious issues, including comprehensive security arrangements and the governance arrangements. Sierra is urging the parties to narrow their differences and reach a final peace deal. UNMISS says at least 210,000 civilians displaced during the nearly five-year conflict are sheltering in UN-run protection of civilian or POC sites across the country. Bong Kubong shelters in the Juba POC.
As long as they are going to implement it, it shouldn't be like the way they usually sign such agreements and at the end they end up fighting again. If they sign that agreement and implement it with spirit and letter, this will actually signify that they are now committed to the peace to end the suffering of the South Sudanese.
Jeremiah Guy, another IDP at the Juba POC, urges the region and the international community to put more pressure on the warring parties to respect the ceasefire.
Right now, we are asking the soldiers in those warring parties, Dr. Machar and his forces, President Kiir and his forces, to silence the guns. Let them stop the fighting among themselves.
Reports of clashes in Wau and Kajokeji over the weekend, or who started them, could not be independently verified. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudan's Police Form 8 is back. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's core value do you live by?
I do value my education a lot because I know that with education I can go anywhere. I can explore the world. I can be whoever I want to be. I can go anywhere. I can do anything I want in life.
I live by the hard working as the core value and prioritizing the priorities. I like it just because when I live in hard working, I know for sure one day I might achieve something which I need in life.
It's respect. I love to be respected and I love to respect other people.
Okay, trust. So I love like someone I can trust. So I want someone to trust me because that's the way to go. Because if you don't trust someone, then there's nothing, there's nowhere you can go forward.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The South Sudan government has reinstated the use of Police Investigation Form 8, a legal requirement before injured people can be treated at area hospitals and clinics. Last week, South Sudan's health minister publicly canceled the use of that form, saying it caused unnecessary delays in providing medical care. But today, the Minister of Interior reinstated the use of Form 8, saying it is an important piece of evidence, especially in cases of sexual violence. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Interior Minister Michael Chinjak says all police units across the country will be instructed to issue Form 8 quickly so that victims are not denied treatment. He told reporters at a news conference in Juba today that back in 2015, former Inspector General of Police Pieng Deng abolished Form 8 from the medical procedure at hospitals because of the delay in helping victims of physical and sexual attacks.
The minister was indeed quoting the order which was made by the former IGP, General Pieng Deng. It was a frustration from him. On the way, sometime police delayed the issuing of Form 8 to the victims, especially the victim of rapes and physical injuries.
The United Nations Population Fund and rights activists celebrated the decision to rescind Form 8 last week, but Chinjak says the move was controversial among law enforcement officials.
The matter provoked a public debate among the security forces and also as well among the legal departments. Because many people believe that absence of Form 8 is a destruction of the evidence, which indeed is true.
As a result, Chinjak says, hospitals and private clinics will continue to ask injured people to fill out Form 8 because it is an important piece of evidence that will enable law enforcement agencies to arrest and punish perpetrators of violence.
As a minister, after the consultation with the Department of Justice, I hereby nullified the order of the former IGP and reinstate the use of Form 8 as mandatory for any victims, because Form 8 is crucial during the investigation and as well in court.
Chinjak urged all victims of sexual and gender-based violence to report their cases to the police so that they can receive justice. Kenyi Yassin, executive director of the Juba law firm Advocates for Human Rights and Democracy, says there is good reason Form 8 is required by law for victims of violence.
According to the Evidence Act, Form 8 is very important for the victims of sexual and gender-based violence to be able to seek for treatment in the hospital and other further medical assistance for counseling maybe, so that in future, if something would arise in the court, that form can be used as evidence.
Yassin says part of the reason the Minister of Health cancelled requiring Form 8 for people who sustain injuries is because many victims of sexual violence refuse to report their cases to the police due to the stigma attached to their cases. Yassin says Health Minister Kok abolished the requirement to fill out the form so that victims would receive treatment regardless of whether they reported their perpetrators to police. Yassin says if Form 8 remains a legal requirement, it should be made readily available to victims who must be encouraged to report their cases.
The form should be available within the doctor units in the hospitals, within the doctor's unit, there must be a doctor who is in charge of this Form 8, those who have been under a sexual and gender-based victims. Actually, there is a law enforcement officer in the hospital. They are there.
Yasin says Form 8 must also remain free of charge so that victims are not denied treatment because they can't afford to buy the form. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
In neighboring Uganda, a group of lawyers have challenged the legality of a controversial social media tax that took effect on July 1st. The government introduced a tax for all social media users in the country to curb what President Yoweri Museveni called rumor-mongering on social media. But opponents of the new tax say it's designed to silence online critics of his government. Halima Atumani reports for VOA from Kampala.
A group of Ugandan lawyers led by Kiza Aaron asked the Constitutional Court Monday to throw out the government's new tax for accessing social media. They argue that it limits freedom of expression and assembly online.
This tax is not meant to generate revenue. This tax is meant to clamp down on free expression. It is meant to inhibit political organization online, and it is going to stifle business startups who are using the social media. Of course, we are seeking for a nullification of the law, which we think is both unreasonable, unnecessary, and illegal.
The new tax will cost each social media user about $2 per month. It targets social media platforms such as WhatsApp, Twitter, Viber, Facebook, and Instagram, among others. Early this year, President Yoweri Museveni explained that the taxes needed to cope with the consequences of gossip. The president's phrasing raised concerns the tax could be used to crack down on criticism of the government online. Uganda's Minister for Information Technology and Communications, Frank Tumwebaze, defended the new tax, known as over-the-top tax services, OTTS.
We are targeting the OTTS because people are preferring them because there is no much cost. So we are saying that money you're donating to the intellectual property owners of WhatsApp and Skype, let the government also pick a shilling. It's a tax on specific value-added services.
You are breaking my order. What? This is our own problem. It is another problem.
What's wrong, Abuja?
A couple of young people thought a protest was in order and took to the street, only to be detained as they approached the parliament. Like most social media users, Christine Nabatanzi opposes the new tax.
Paying that 200 shillings is unjustifiable daily. Eh? First of all, I need social media according to the work I do. Secondly, where do all the taxes that the government collects go? We are saying we are paying so many taxes, local government taxes, do you pay as you earn, do you what? But the services are very poor. We have no roads, foremost. We have no drugs in hospitals. We have no good schools. Where do the taxes go?
The Ugandan government hopes to collect over $400 million annually from the social media tax. However, many Ugandans are using virtual private networks, VPNs, to evade paying the new tax, despite the risk of being prosecuted for tax evasion. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
The African Union summit wraps up today in Nouakchott, Mauritania, after its agenda was diverted by three terrorist attacks in Mali. Mauritanian President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz said a lack of international help was undercutting security in the Sahel. He said Africa needs a comprehensive plan to battle extremists, but one that takes into consideration the cultural and economic issues that cause the violence. A bomb in Mali on Friday killed three civilians, and four Mali soldiers died on Saturday when their vehicle hit a landmine. Yesterday, at least two people died in a car bombing that also injured several French soldiers on patrol. Leaders of the summit intended to focus on funding issues and reforms, as well as ways for governments to return funds illegally siphoned off from sales of the continent's vast resources. The gathering of more than 40 African leaders wraps up after an appearance by French President Emmanuel Macron. Poetry is a popular form of activism and self-expression among many South Sudanese, but it can also be used as a tool to mend broken relationships. As Ayan Deng Bior reports from Washington, a new book by a South Sudanese poet is aimed at doing just that.
Mass activism movements like Anna Taban have capitalized on the arts, including spoken word, to communicate the experiences of people. The consequences of South Sudan's conflict have impacted almost every sector of society for the past 4.5 years. South Sudanese poet Apuk Ayuel Mayen says writing poetry has been the easiest way for her to communicate her emotions.
Poetry is personal, and it but it also allows you to basically reflect your true feelings and thoughts about something. When I started writing, I wasn't writing to write a book. I was writing for myself. And I think because of that accessibility of poetry as a medium, it's so popular.
No More Betrayals is the title of Ayuel's latest book. It's a collection of 25 poems spanning a wide range of emotions that revolve around the South Sudan experience. The poem with the title No More Betrayals speaks of the laughter of the pure-hearted, which has been muted by what Ayuel calls the drums of war.
For me, in this poem, I choose to speak as South Sudan, the way a mother would speak to her children, admonishing them to not betray their bloodline, to not betray our brotherhood and sisterhood, and to remember that we are one people. I choose to speak as South Sudan, asking us to look beyond our political differences that basically engulf us in this cycle of revenge and violence.
Poems like Not Just a Woman explore the hardened realities that many women face. One line from the poem reads, "I must guard my life above my dignity. I must endure, for he who earned me freedom has the sole right to oppress me."
That line that you read was quite strong and accusatory. But if you continue reading, you will see that this is about a feminism that doesn't believe in an antagonism between the sexes. But it aspires to inspire men and women to collaborate for better humanity.
No More Betrayals is available on the online marketplace Amazon. Ayuel says she is working to organize a launching event on July 15th in Juba. You can connect with the author on Twitter. Her handle is @ApukAyuel, or on her website, apukmayen.com, for more information. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
And that's our show for this Monday. We'll leave you with the song McColl by Makumba. We've been listening to Makumba with the song McColl. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. How did you like today's show? Well, you can share your comments with us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com, or you can reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Hey, Gayanto, Melody, Temple, Hey, Gayanto, Mokomo.